Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, hi. I'm Molly Wood. I'm back. I missed you guys. You are listening to Make Me Smart, despite the slightly unfamiliar beginning. This is the show where we connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture. This time, Kai is out because of summer. And so I win because we have Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams in the host seat from D.C. Hello.
Hey, hey. It is good to be here. And I'm excited because I get to do the tagline, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Excellent. Well done. Well played. Kimberly and I are fulfilling a years-long dream.
Literally years-long.
It really is. We have the Slack chats to prove it, which is to do an all-lady podcast talking about space. Space. Yes. You may know that I am a big space nerd from way back. And years ago on Slack, found another space nerd at Marketplace in Kimberly.
Thank you, Molly. The nerddom is very, very serious with this one.
It's so
I
real.
Have like
it's
a so space real. Business Twitter list if anyone cares to give it a follow.
Yeah. And in fact, her Slack bio internally literally says planetary defense officer and, quote, still want to be an astronaut. So you know that it's real. But the one thing that we've been talking about, so this is a great time to be doing this episode because there is a lot of space in the news, not least of which, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. There is a ton of media coverage events around that. I'm sure some more athletes will come out and tell us that it either was not true or that the Earth is flat or something.
I can't.
In Washington, D.C., an image of the Saturn V rocket that went to the moon will be projected onto the Washington Monument. Apparently. Can you confirm?
Yes. I saw them setting it up this morning when I was on my bus ride in. So they're going to like make the Washington Monument into the rocket. And they've got all these screens set up around it so it can be like smoke. And I'm definitely going this weekend to see it.
Oh, my God. It must be. It's like your most favorite. It's like Christmas in D.C.
Basically.
So and then what we really want to talk about today is this sort of nascent economy. This has been Kimberly's and my premise for the duration of our space chats. Is not that this is just like a thing that we can geek out about and a shared sci-fi love and
although that
thing
is valuable,
that sparks the human imagination. Exactly, those are all valuable and all true. But there's a lot of money at stake here.
So much money,
and it's only heating up. So President Trump announced earlier this year that he wants to send humans back to the moon by 2024 or maybe to Mars. There was a little confusion there. Richard Branson is taking Virgin Galactic public as the first public company to put tourists in space. The private sector, of course, is all over this. There's SpaceX. There's Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. There are a million different sort of micro rocket startups and CubeSats and so many others who are finding these huge business opportunities in space. And so we wanted to take today's episode and look at, you know, what makes up the space economy, how big could it be, and what does it have to do with us here on Earth?
And to help us break that down, I have here in the studio with me in D.C., Jacqueline Felcher. She has the space beat over at Politico. She's their national security reporter, and she runs the newsletter Politico Space. And I will admit, I am quite jealous of you for that, but welcome to the program anyway.
Thank you for having me. I have a very good job. I'm very lucky.
I know. We're like, hopefully our bosses aren't listening, but let's talk later. Jacqueline, would you say, I want to dive right in with this idea about where we are in the space economy. How nascent is it really? Do you think that we are at an inflection point right now, or has this been, you know, a bigger economy than maybe people realized all along?
I think a little bit of both. I do think it's a bigger economy than people realize. I don't think a lot of people realize that the GPS signal that lets their Uber find them actually comes from space, or that DirecTV is coming from space, and internet in a lot of rural parts of the country comes from space. So I think there is already a large space economy, but we're also really at this point where really exciting things are happening. People are talking about, you know, mining the moon and working on satellites in orbit and, you know, having gas stations on the moon to be able to refuel and go into space. So there's all this really cool stuff that's kind of on the horizon. There's, you know, a lot of question about how much of it is actually going to come to fruition. There are a lot of big dreamers in this space, and, you know, it's almost
space.
Certain. It's almost certain that 100% of this is not going to happen. But even if only half of it happens, it will still be very, very cool.
And how much money are we talking about? I mean, every time you hear about space, it always seems to have like a million or a billion, and some people even say trillion attached to it. So, like, lay out the numbers for us.
So there was actually a report that came out this week. In 2018, the global space economy surpassed $400 billion for the first time in 2018. So we are talking about a lot of money, and the Commerce Secretary is predicting that it could reach $1 trillion by 2040. Because it's expensive to go to space, and there's a lot that can be done up there, and a lot of kind of unfulfilled potential right now. So it is, when you talk about space, you're talking about big numbers.
I'm spending a moment on DuckDuckGo to try to figure out what else is a $400 billion
industry. Yeah, I was just
thinking
about that. Like, what would you compare that economy to? I mean, I imagine that's the economy of some small countries.
I think it probably is, like, online learning is $100 billion. Used computer equipment, apparently, it might be a $400 billion business. Anyway, we'll find some comparison points there for context. But let's talk about 20 years from now. You know, right now, of course, there's space tourism. There have been floated the idea of space colonies. There's space mining. There's space manufacturing. Can you sort of paint a picture as we go forward of what some of these companies and what some of these dominant industries might start to be?
Yeah, I mean, going to the moon is definitely a really exciting example, and it will be very, very different from when we were going to the moon decades ago. People are talking about, you know, living and working on the moon. There's a Japanese company called iSpace that is trying to go to the moon with rovers and then build a moon village, where people can, you know, live there, and there are tons and tons and tons of ice on the poles of the moon that can be mined and, you know, melted for life support for people to drink, or it can be broken down into hydrogen and oxygen to actually fuel rockets. So the idea behind what this company wants to do is that the moon will basically be like a gas station. People can go to the moon and refill there on hydrogen that's been broken down from water and then continue on to Mars. And when you talk about sort of the economics of that, you also have to think about there are going to be people living there. So, you know, people are looking at being architects in space. How do you design cities and houses when there's less gravity? You know, people won't necessarily, that they'll be able to jump higher. Can stairs be bigger? Like, that sorts of stuff, which is really crazy. I also recently talked to someone who's dedicating this. She's working on a nonprofit to protect the Apollo 11 lunar landing site, with the idea that, like, her kids can go to, like, the national park on the moon to see these boot prints, the first boot prints on the moon.
That was in the book that you guys had on Make Me Smart, Molly. Which, when was that?
You mean the newest Andy Weir one, Artemis?
Yeah, yeah. There,
yes.
That was it, Artemis. There was a moment in Artemis where there's a space, a museum on the moon for exactly
so
what you're
cool.
describing.
Yep, totally.
So yeah, there's definitely like a lot of untapped potential on the moon, especially in terms of mining, and, you know, people can be mining asteroids too. There's like a lot to be done in that sphere.
Right.
So, I mean, the big companies we hear about all the time are SpaceX and Blue Origin. You mentioned a couple of other ones, but, I mean, who's really kind of on the cutting edge of, like, these startup businesses that might actually change the way we think about space in the future?
So I feel like those are kind of like the big two. There are a lot on like a lower tier, and it's kind of yet to be seen who's going to jump up to that mid-tier kind of company. Made in Space is talking about launching a 3D printer into space, and then, you know, you'll be able to mine asteroids and get metal from these asteroids that you can then feed into this 3D printer in space to be able to actually make stuff in space, which is huge for being able to launch stuff. It's that the greatest cost of operating in space is getting the mass off of Earth. So if you can not have to launch it and just make it in space, that's huge. There are a lot of sort of smaller launch companies. The companies you're talking about, SpaceX and Blue Origin, have much bigger rockets that are going to be doing, you know, a lot of government missions, but there are a lot of small launch companies kind of coming up that will be able to launch the CubeSats that you were talking about earlier and sort of launch smaller payloads. You know, people have talked about a bubble in the launch industry and sort of how many small launch companies there can be to support the business model that's out there. So that's sort of still to be seen, but there are a lot of launch startups as well that are working on that.
And then not for nothing, as long as we're making a space-based reading list, the idea of a cislunar economy where most of the work actually happens in space already to reduce the amount of energy and money needed to launch is the kind of plot point of Delta V, which is the new book by Daniel Suarez. Look at that, an impromptu book list to go along with this. I don't want to buzzkill completely, but obviously this is not going to be without many concerns and obstacles and unintended consequences, right? I mean, what could go wrong as we try to develop this economy from both the private industry perspective and the geopolitical perspective?
I mean, there are just enormous risks. Just earlier this year, we saw SpaceX did a test on one of their new capsules, which is going to launch astronauts for NASA, and it just exploded on the capsule. So, like, if things go wrong in space, they go very, very wrong. I mean, there are huge risks to all of this because none of it's been done before. Talking about, you know, the geopolitical consequences, we look at the International Space Station as an example of great success. A number of countries came together, working together. You know, the U.S. and Russia have worked together peacefully in space for years, which is sort of unthinkable, especially, you know, right in the wake of the Cold War. This was a thing that was happening. But, I mean, there are absolutely potentials for it to go wrong. You look at China is doing so many cool things in space, both scientific and military and commercial. There's a lot of concern about China stealing intellectual property from U.S. companies or, you know, buying U.S. companies and having that technology no longer be in the U.S. supply chain. So it's definitely, I mean, space belongs to the whole world. So it's definitely a global consideration when you look at this.
But you bring up a good point, because for the last 50 years, space exploration was pretty much government funded and run by governments. And now it is shifting increasingly towards private industries launching into space, maintaining the space infrastructure, especially in low Earth orbit. I mean, what are the consequences of that shift from various governments managing this to private companies?
I mean, NASA would tell you this is a very good thing. NASA wants the private industry to be in low Earth orbit, to take over some of the missions of the International Space Station and to have commercial companies on the International Space Station, because that then enables NASA to go to the moon. Right now, there isn't really a super strong business case for the moon, but if NASA goes first, then there can be. So then kind of, I think NASA has said that they want their plan to be to sort of be out ahead and let the private industry sort of come in behind them and backfill, such that NASA can then devote its resources to the next cool thing, because there will always be government missions. There's no financial incentive to go land on an asteroid and figure out like what happened at the Big Bang. Like, that is a scientific mission that will always belong to government space agencies. So there, the private and government sides are definitely right now, I think they're in a period of kind of figuring out who does what and how best to work together. But I definitely don't think it's going to be, you know, one or the other going forward.
This might feel a little out of left field, but we've been doing a series on Marketplace Tech covering how tech can help us adapt to climate change. And interestingly, I think you're starting to see this conversation. Certainly Elon Musk has made the environment a part of the conversation about the imperative of going to space. You recently heard Jeff Bezos say, look, we're probably going to have to move our manufacturing and maybe our colonies to space because of what he called pollution here on Earth. But I just wonder how much you see that starting to be part of the conversation, the idea that industrialization specifically could go to space to ease the burden on Earth.
Yeah. When Jeff Bezos talked about that, I mean, I tweeted about it in my Twitter mentions. People got really mad about him saying, well, let's just put all the pollution in this one pod in space and that will fix everything. Right. It's really interesting because there have been several polls over the past couple of years where people have asked the American public, what do you think NASA's main mission should be? And it's not landing humans on Mars. It's not doing science. It's studying climate change and protecting the Earth from asteroids. People really want NASA to keep the U.S. safe from those sorts of things. So, I mean, that's definitely a part of the space mission in terms of being able to observe Earth. I think in terms of how space relates to climate change, it's more like observing the Earth and being able to take measurements from space than it is kind of leaving the planet just yet.
Which was, yeah. I have to say, the whole premise of WALL-E.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Add that to your list, everyone.
Add it to the list. But to go back to the serious stuff, I mean, what NASA and other space agencies are doing, though, they are doing some of the climate change research and everything like that. But also, there is this push to get to the moon, for example. And it does seem like we're entering a bit of like a space race 2.0 with China, India, Israel, and everybody else who possibly can trying to get to the moon. President Trump said he wanted us to go back there and, you know, really pushed for NASA to get there, what was it, by 2024? Mm-hmm. And then he tweeted saying it was a waste of time and we needed to focus on Mars. But regardless, how much of this is going to be, how much of the space economy is going to be intertwined into geopolitics and national security in addition to this commercial side of things we've been discussing?
Yeah, I've talked to some company CEOs because the Trump administration has been very, very focused on space, more so than a lot of recent administrations, talking about, you know, both the military space but also the commercial space. Trump loves talking about how rich guys love rockets. And that kind of flashlight shined on the industry, I think, has made a big difference. So I've talked with people about sort of what happens in the next administration. Does this whole thing just kind of collapse if it doesn't have this attention at a high level? And people tell me that it's really the commercial space sector has reached this point where it's going to happen with or without the political support or kind of regardless of what the government says. These companies are going there. They have backers. You know, they're doing what they're doing. I mean, in terms of getting to the moon, that's really entirely a political question. It's up to Congress to fund the mission to get to the moon in 2024. The Trump administration has asked for $1.6 billion in fiscal 2020, but they think it's going to cost up to $30 billion to do it over the lifespan of the program. So, you know, depending on what happens in the 2020 election, that effort could absolutely die if it doesn't have support from D.C.
All right. We could probably do this all day. But one more question. What about, speaking of efforts that may or may not die, depending on the 2020 election, what about Space Force? What about the sort of military implications of all of these moves?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I was going to get out of one interview without talking about Space Force. It's always
nope,
Space Force.
Not this one.
Not here.
Because unfortunately, my 12-year-old heard about it and was like, what is Space Force? I need to know why we need that. I might want to join.
People love talking about it. But I also think, you know, what people love talking about is like Marines with lightsabers and jetpacks. And it's like not that at all. It's people sitting in dark rooms looking at screens, you know, monitoring what's going on with the U.S. satellites. But really, the fact that the space economy is growing is like a large reason why the country may need a space force or at the very least needs more of a focus on space. You know, we have a Navy to protect U.S. flagged ships doing business on the oceans. And, you know, the argument is that there are going to be billions of dollars of business in space that needs to be protected as well.
Yeah. Jacqueline Felcher is a national security reporter for Politico and the writer of the newsletter Politico Space. Thank you for coming on and sharing a little bit of your dream job, our dream job, with us.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Despite the green jealousy over here, it's cool.
So great. Little green men type green?
No,
okay.
Little green women.
I'm not doing that again. I would like to point out, thanks to our producers who found out that the global carbonated soft drinks market is a $400 billion industry. So space currently already as big as Coke and Pepsi. That was a good one. That's
a
good
one. The more you know.
So in addition to Jacqueline's dream job, with this new space economy, there are actually going to be lots of new careers we didn't even know existed. I recently became obsessed with trying to become a space lawyer in my second act of my life.
Real job.
And it's a real job. And so I found out, by the way, that there are two American universities that actually offer. One is a doctorate level program in space.
Do you have to have a law degree first?
Well, so I think it's the University of Mississippi offers a graduate certificate for non-lawyers. Let's talk
nice.
After the show.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Anyway, basically, every industry on Earth is going to have some kind of a counterpart in space. And so we wanted to explore what just one of those new industries is looking like, one that Jacqueline actually mentioned.
Right. Brent Sherwood is a real job space architect living in Los Angeles. He's worked at places like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and he's about to start working at Blue Origin. Our producer, Shara Morris, caught up with him to hear more about his job.
When I was 5 years old, all I wanted to do was build cities on the moon. And I have always wanted to do that. I still want to do that. And I'm not going to give up until it's on its way. I'm Brent Sherwood. I'm the chair of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics Technical Committee for Space Architecture. Space architects do a variety of things. There's very little actual work yet in space architecture, but it has a kind of allure. And I think that's because it's the connection between people imagining space and imagining themselves in space. That's what space architecture is. As more people are living and working in space, we'll need to pay more and more attention to how to make human living as normal and productive and satisfying as possible. So imagine a quarter century from now being able to take your honeymoon or a two-week vacation in Earth orbit. And so that would be in a resort hotel facility where you have the ride of your life for 8 minutes to get up into space. You have the most incredible view out the window that's changing all the time, 18 sunrises and sunsets every day. And you get to play with your food and zero gravity and have zero-G sex and all the kinds of things that people might want to do in space on a vacation. And then it takes about a half an hour to come home. So for that to happen, we need these kinds of service industries I mentioned earlier and the facilities, we call them destination systems, to be able to support that. But you also need the transportation systems to get them there and back. We can imagine a kind of space architecture to support that, which includes dormitories for workers. It includes assembly spaces where you have a community of more than just five astronauts at a time. You know, if you have 20 or 50 or 300, they need to be able to get together. There'll be recreation facilities, which almost certainly need to include the opportunity for new sports in low gravity and 1/6 gravity on the surface of the moon. All the kinds of things that we think of when we think of normal life on Earth, we just have to build it from the ground up in space.
Amazing. As if, like, architect wasn't already the coolest job on Earth, right? Isn't there something
right?
just so cool about architects? And then you just are, oh, by the way, I do that in space.
I think if you add space to just about anything, it makes it infinitely cooler.
That is actually a really good point. Space accountant, boom. Awesome.
Yeah. Space journalist, just putting it out there.
Uh-huh. Hint, hint. Just saying, this is a great idea for a podcast marketplace. you can continue, before I get us both, actually, the opposite of new podcast and fired, you can continue to get smart with us about space. We're basically doing a takeover, and all next week, you're going to get some space-themed explainers on your Amazon Echo. I'm going to take a little pause. This is sort of like a spoiler alert. Move away from your Echo, just real quick. Okay, If you have one of these devices or a show or whatever, Amazon Doodly, all you have to say is, Alexa, make me smart. And then you get a short explainer and a new one every day from Kai and me. And like I said, space takeover. Next week, they're going to all be about space. Now, again, if you have an Amazon Echo that you are far away from, just say, Alexa, make me smart, and you're in.
Now we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to do our fixations.
And we're back. We've returned to orbit. Actually, we totally haven't because the space takeover continues. We are going to fixate. Kimberly, what are you into? What's on your mind?
Because I've been thinking about space, it actually took me back to even before we started our Geek Out Slack conversations about space. When I first came to Marketplace in 2015, I did a three-part series on orbital debris, aka space junk. And I just I'm still stuck on it because there is so much debris already up in space and, you know, it's really going to be a thing. Like every single launch, I mean, Jacqueline was talking about everybody planning to launch all these thousands and thousands of satellites, and a lot of them just stay up there. And it becomes like dodgeball when you're trying to launch something to avoid the cloud of things. And as we learned from Sandra Bullock, space debris can be dangerous. And so I'm very fascinated, to see how companies and governments are going to continue to deal with this. There have been several initiatives to test out different ways of capturing the debris, different ways of, you know, putting rules in place so that satellites have to decommission themselves where they degrade in their orbit and eventually just burn up in the atmosphere after a certain amount of time. And also, there are even some experiments to try to go out there and catch it. And one of the things that I discovered when I was researching these stories back in 2015 is that there's this old Japanese anime that is all about a team of astronauts that goes out all the time to collect space junk.
Wow. Okay, we have such a good reading and viewing list going, and I'm going to add to it slightly.
Oh, it's called Planetes, by the way.
Nice. I think that the space debris is fascinating and kind of undersold. I mean, we're talking about it, but it is a huge deal that's only getting bigger. And in fact, we saw sort of there's the space debris part. And then I read some terrifying thing that said that all of the debris could at some point vaporize and then be trapped in orbit and basically just have this layer that interferes with all of our communication and or totally changes our climate. And then I also, in my brain, mixed that up with Seven Eves because the Neal Stephenson book, reading list, ding, in which at the beginning the moon is destroyed by a mysterious agent and ends up spreading into pieces that go into orbit and destroy the Earth's atmosphere. I'm off the rails. However,
this is such a bright and uplifting conversation as we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
I know. But it ties right into actually the thing that I'm fixated on, because recently SpaceX, of course, launched all of its just a few hundred of the thousands of satellites that it intends to launch to provide internet access. Yeah. Back here on Earth. And when they first launched, they were super visible and astronomers freaked out because they were like, we can see these satellites, in some cases with the naked eye, but certainly with telescopes. They were afraid it was going to interfere with radio astronomy and still might, because they plan to launch thousands more. Now, as they oriented in the sky, they were less reflective.
Yeah, I think we should unpack that a little bit, because these satellites are
definitely,
bright, shiny, clean metal. Depending on where they are in the sky relative to the sun, they were literally lighting up like stars. And so the orienting of the satellite that you're talking about was them sort of adjusting to be less shiny.
Right. But when they first launched, astronomers said they were brighter than the brightest stars. And Elon Musk, of course, responded right away and said, look, I'm not trying to screw up the entire landscape. Skyscape. But it's going to change. And then now, so that already happened in this sort of space debris and visible, the idea that there is a cityscape that is space. If we, for example, move factories up there, those will be visible from Earth. Like, things are really going to change in the night sky. And relevant to that, Amazon filed paperwork a week ago asking for permission to launch its own thousands of satellites for a sort of a global broadband internet network. So the problem of orbiting space debris in the form of actual satellites, let alone debris, is only going to increase. Like, I don't know, when humans go somewhere, it's like ants swarming a dead fly on the ground. I got a little
but
dark.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about, you know, sort of two different kinds of, you know, between what we're discussing right now and what Jacqueline was saying earlier, two different types of space economies. There's this low Earth orbit of the satellites and the junk and the tourism and going up and down. And then there's sort of the further out part of the space economy where going to the moon, going to Mars, potentially elsewhere, setting up factories, harvesting asteroids, and then, you know, are you making stuff for out in space or gathering items to bring them back from space? And so there's so many different layers of this economy. And now that we know, thanks to you, Molly, and thanks to Shara, that our producer, that the space economy is roughly the size of the soda industry, that, you know, what is that money coming from? Like, when you take that much money from the regular economy to a part of the economy that didn't exist in the past, like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Right. And what does it mean for an ongoing... First of all, I want to say that is such a good delineation about at least what exists now as the two major types of sort of space industry, low Earth orbit and maybe far Earth or deep space businesses. But we talk a lot about growth on this podcast and how capitalism depends on growth. And, you know, the ongoing creation of money and places to put that money depend on growth. And that is a big part of the commercial push for space, a big part of the business argument, the business case to be made for it, is that at some point, when it comes to resources, places to put humans, you know, future business opportunities, we have to look beyond Earth, which is just sort of an interesting capitalism argument.
And every time you think about growth, there's always the question of growth for whom? Who gets to be the people who benefit from this new segment of an economy that is growing pretty quickly?
Yeah, exactly. All right, we are going to let you guys do the talking for a minute in the mailbox.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Last week, while I was away, Kai co-hosted Make Me Smart with Rima Kreis, and the episode was about the decline in history majors, and even more than that, this decline in historical thinking, how history helps us think critically. And so we asked all you history majors out there how it impacts your life. Brian Goldstein is a web developer in Alexandria, Virginia, and ding, history major.
Basically, having a humanities degree, in particular a history degree, gives me a better idea of what it is that is valuable in terms of like the human cost and also why something would be important. It gives me context that is just not discussed in technical or professional courses.
That seems kind of terrifying that it's not discussed in technical or professional courses, but there we go.
I mean, context is key, right? And knowing whether something happened before and how it went down then or not is useful context, especially in the era of hot takes. Jean-Claude Munyakundi said history can also help us understand probability.
It would have been great to also include the concept of path dependence in this discussion. The notion that history, past choices and decisions, determine not just the current state of our economy, technology, and institutions, but also the path of evolution that is feasible given where we are and where we have been. To know the cost or even the likelihood of getting where the country needs or wants to go.
Oh, man. Longtime listeners to this show will know that had I been here, I definitely would have said path dependency, which is my weird obsession, so much so that it became a borderline drinking game on this podcast. I am fascinated with this idea that there's no determination. Like, had we made a totally different choice, we might not even know how to make cars, that kind of thing. I love that.
Or cars might have been electric.
Right?
Well, I mean, they are electric, but they would have been electric earlier.
Right. Ugh, amazing. All right. Jonathan Boyd has a degree in Russian history, and here's his experience with the major.
I will admit, having a Russian history degree on my resume makes it more difficult to convince people I can be a project manager on a software or systems engineering project. When I turned 40, in fact, one of my best friends from my 20s flat out asked me, "Jonathan, how do you still have a job?" But knowing how to read and write well and how to think critically about how events are unfolding certainly has helped me throughout my career.
I'm curious as to whether or not his, you know, question about being still employed has more to do with the Russian aspect and software, or if it has to do with the history aspect and software.
I don't really know. But Jonathan, people ask me that all the time. No, I'm just kidding. Not true. Not true.
I will take the privilege and say it is time for the Make Me Smart question. What's something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Diana Trujillo is the Mars 2020 Armed Surface Science Lead at NASA, and here's what she had to say.
To me, it's the fact that, you know, you look at the spacecraft and you look at all the missions that have landed on Mars, and you think that it narrows down to a few people that are extremely smart. And you have this picture that they look all like Einstein and that they're all men. But when you actually do it, you recognize that it's actually a team of people. It's a team of people that get to know you as a person. It's a team of people that will see you at 3 a.m, cranky or happy, whichever side you are, if you're a morning person like me. But I think that that was the thing that I was wrong about. It was that we were actually doing it together as a team and not as 3 or 4 people that were smart and separate from everybody else.
Aw, go team.
Oh, my goodness. I know. That's amazing. And go. You know, it's funny. I feel like the last few years, there's just been this sort of regular, since Hidden Figures, this regular thread of discovering the cool women that have been on the hidden back end of the space industry. So here's Diana out in front.
When I started building my Twitter list a couple years ago, it was really wonderful to discover all of these smart journalists and scientists and policy makers in the space field and in the businesses related to space that were out there talking about these issues, you know, really early. And then, you know, when you and I connected on Slack and started brainstorming like all these ideas about how we could squeeze in more space coverage on Marketplace. It's just a lot of fun.
I know. And I'm so delighted that it came to fruition, at least with this episode and hopefully many
more. Well, we talk about it on tech a lot.
We do. On Marketplace Tech, we basically have a whole ongoing series covering the space economy. Because like we said, I mean, we're a business show and we would be, what's the word I'm looking for? Bereft.
We'd be remiss
if we, we'd be terrible at our jobs if we didn't cover the space business because, like we said,
absolutely,
it's as big as Coke and Pepsi. Don't forget, if you are at your computer, market, Make Me Smart has a newsletter that gets you smart throughout the week. And there are all these fun segments on there, like Smart in a Shot, where we talk about things like the NBA's pay cap structure, which if you've been following free agency is amazing. Recently, there was a Choose Your Own Adventure Twitter thread that went viral. That was awesome. And of course, we feature you and your thoughts and your recommendations. This newsletter is actually great reading, and you should subscribe. Tell us what's making you smarter and subscribe at marketplace.org/newsletters.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Heathcoat and Summer Dunsmore. Christian Buckler is helping us out here in D.C.
Special thanks, of course, to you, Kimberly Adams. You can check out her work at marketplace.org. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by that very same Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Remember all those names we came up with for our all-lady space ideas, space podcast?
Like, so many.
Didn't even occur to me this was all ladies until just now. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I kind of didn't until I heard us all talking, and then I was like, oh, this is amazing.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.